Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Edward Enninful has helped his industry expand. He's used gorgeous dark-skinned models on his covers and asserted that zero should no longer be considered a perfect size in fashion. He does this work on the pages of British Vogue, where he is editor-in-chief, and in his work as Vogue European editorial director. But when it came time to write about himself, he needed some encouragement. One day he was taking a walk in London's Hyde Park with a friend. His friend encouraged him not to write the boy from Ghana making his way in a racist, classist industry and the struggles along the way kind of book that made Enninful sigh, but rather one that showed glamour and swagger and power and success. That friend was, wait for it, Idris Elba. Idris is not the only well-known supporter of Enninful's memoir. Take a listen to a few friends, including Tilda Swinton, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Joel Edgerton, and Jodie Smith-Turner, all clad in black suits like Enninful often wears, reading from his new memoir, A Visible Man. The first voice you'll hear is Academy Award winner Daniel Kaluuya.
A Visible Man, by me, Edward Enninful.
We lived in community too.
We'd hear the gunshots crack as their bodies would slump.
Oh, is it firing squad day?
If I had been edging around the question of my sexual orientation.
The guy grabbed me and we started making out.
Franca's whole face lit up. Edward Enninful, the stylist. My God, I love your work.
Oh, honey. Out came furs, lace, leather, fashion.
Edward, I'd love you to come in and meet Anna.
I just figured, okay, they're white, it's over. It's for trust fund girls and not for me.
Racism? XO, XO.
I was confronted by a security guard.
A white woman who looked me up and down.
Loading bay! Deliveries go through the loading bay!
Maybe your ego's just too big because you weren't recognized.
A Visible Man is the result of deep reflection of Enninful's early years growing up around army bases in Ghana, his tense relationship with his father, his inspiration of a mother. Prodigy-like, he was running ID Magazine at just 18, which launched his very successful career, one he has used to make necessary and important changes to his industry. Now, of course, it wasn't a smooth ride. He faced illness, he faced gatekeepers, he faced unhealthy self-medicating and behaviors. Edward Enninful writes in his book, "I don't mind admitting I was a little bit frightened to write this memoir. My own story is inextricably bound up in my struggle to make fashion respond to the world and in doing so, help the world evolve too." Joining me now to discuss his memoir, Invisible Man, which is now out, is Edward Enninful. Edward will be speaking at the Apollo Theater tonight at 7:30 p.m. and 7 p.m. tomorrow at the Strand. And we are grateful to have him first here now. Hi, Edward.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very excited. So A Visible Man, immediately for all of us literature nerds, we go right to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, where the narrator feels his humanity is not recognized, that he's invisible to others, and he retreats. When did you know in your life that you would not retreat, that you were going to be a visible human?
I mean, I think it must have been when we got to London. You know, I'd grown up in London, in Ghana, on a military base, and I grew up in a country where everybody was black. And then we arrived in England, and I realized I was different. I realized I was the other. So from then on, you know, I really had to show that I was visible, that I was black, gay, working class, a refugee, and my whole life was about, with each knockback, I was not going to stay invisible. You were going to see me, and I was going to make myself visible. So really, that's where that came from.
What was one of your first moves when you got some power, in a position of power, to make others feel seen?
I mean, for me, you know, having grown up with a mother who made incredible clothes, you know, and growing up around incredible women of all shapes and sizes, and just vivacious women, you know, beauty in all its shapes and form. I just really wanted to the world, you know, the world of magazines to reflect that. So I just opened the door for women of all races, all ages, sizes, religion, socioeconomic background, you name it. For me, everybody was welcome in the pages. So when I was a young kid at ID to my position right now, inclusivity and diversity for me were beautiful, beautiful words, really.
What was the most annoying pushback you got initially? Something
the most annoying pushback was when I would hear things like, Non-white models don't sell. Black models especially don't sell. And I was like, this is a myth. Here we go. And then we started, you know, from day one, just I had Ajwa Abor on my first cover of British Vogue. And every year, you know, there's at least six, seven models of color. And we sell, you know, it's amazing to be able to turn around such a myth. And at the moment, the industry sort of embraced the idea that women of all sizes and, you know, backgrounds, like we said, must be welcome. And I'm really glad to have played a part in that.
Let's go all the way back. You're born February 22nd, 1972, fifth child of what would be six siblings in total. What is something about you that lets me know you're from a big family?
I love being around lots of people. I'm very good in sort of public spaces. I am not, like, I don't need to be on my own all the time. I'm good in groups. I'm good in, you know, working with a team. I'm good. Anything that involves a group of people, I'm really great at, because we grew up as a bit of a tribe. Six kids, that's a tribe.
You write about your memories of Ghana. When I remember my childhood, it's powerful scents that come rushing back to me first. What sense comes to mind? What olfactory memories do you get?
It's food. If you know Ghanaian food, they're very sort of flavorsome. Lots of chili, lots of peppers, lots of fried, so like fried fish and soups and fried red. So it's really the smell of food. It's a very specific smell. Even to this day, when I go to a Ghanaian person's house, you can smell it, the lingering aroma of food.
What happens to you emotionally when that scent hits you?
I mean, it kind of takes me back to when I was growing up. And, you know, when I was growing up, I was always sort of around my mother, who sort of loved me very much and looked after me. So it sort of reminds me of my mother who passed a while ago. But it really is of happy times, I have to say.
You describe your mother, Grace, as my, quote, comforter and my champion. So she had her own dressmaking business. Yes. With more than 30 employees, you would be by her side in the shop. What is something you learned about style and clothing and the making of clothing that has stayed with you?
Yes. I mean, you know, everything I know about clothes, I learned from my mother. I can really make clothes. I can customize clothes. I also know when a woman feels really beautiful. You know, my mother would let me zip women up into clothes, would let me sort of play with eyelets, would let me sketch with her. And, you know, she taught me that beauty comes in all forms, that it wasn't just, you didn't have to be skinny and want to be beautiful. So for me growing up, that's what I knew was beautiful, you know, all shapes and sizes. So that's really stayed with me. So when people say, oh, it's a revolution, I'm like, that's just what my mom taught me, that all women are beautiful. So that's from her.
What's a secret you learned watching her tailor clothes about clothing?
I learned that watch the woman wearing the clothes very carefully, because if they're unhappy, you can tell by an expression, you can tell by a subtle wiggle, you know, a sudden idea of discomfort. So that stayed with me throughout my whole career. So in my book, I talk about if I work with Beyonce or Rihanna or Taylor Swift, I can tell 2 seconds if they're happy in what they're wearing. They don't even need to say a word.
Yeah, you see, you write in the book about how just a look comes over someone's, their faces.
Yes, you can tell.
In that moment, that's whether it's displeasure or discomfort. Can you tell the difference between displeasure and discomfort?
I mean, it's almost like it's this look that I've come to know over the years. It's kind of a very, it's almost like a fleeting second of an interesting, a questioning look. Because when someone's really happy in what they look, it's happiness. Before they start, it's a questioning look of, do I look good in this, that I learned from my mom.
And when you're a woman of that position who's photographed that much, who is judged rightly or wrongly that much, that question is really important to make that question go away.
Yes, really important. And for me, you know, because I sort of started off by working with, like I said, women of you know, the kaleidoscope of women, mm-hmm. it was never a problem for me to work with anybody who wasn't a standard zero. Actually, I barely work with anybody who's a standard zero anymore. You know, so I just love just making women feel beautiful, really.
My guest is Edward Enninful. He's editor-in-chief of British Vogue and European editorial director for Vogue. His new memoir is called A Visible Man. It is out now. Your dad served in the military. It means you grew up on various army bases. And he was a disciplinarian. Very bottom line. Serious person. How did that method of parenting shape how you approach work?
I mean, my dad was sort of a product of his era. He was an African military man, very strict, very organized, sort of, you know, very focused on his idea of how to bring up children, which was at odds with who I am, because I was so soft and so spacey and so creative that I would be terrorized sometimes, you know. Sometimes I would just hide my sketches because I felt like that's not what you did as a boy. You know, my brothers would be out playing football and I wasn't there. So he was particularly strict on me. But fast forward, what I've learned from him, the reason why I'm able to sort of run a magazine and run a whole, whole multiple editions of Vogue is I learned about precision, timing, organization. Those were the things I got from him. And the creativity and the dreaminess I got from my mother. So in the end, even though we were at odds a lot and he didn't quite understand me and I didn't understand him, I took from him this strong sense of, this strong work ethic and discipline.
You said you were spacey. What was going on with you when you were spacing out as a little guy? Were you just
living in a
fantasy land? Were you thinking about what were you creating in your brain?
I mean, I was creating images. I was, you know, I told you when I was in my book, I talked about when I was young and I discovered my aunt was a hairdresser. She had a fabulous place called Dolly Dots. And I remember, I can't even remember how old I was, so young, walking in and discovering magazines, seeing a magazine called Ebony and another one called Jet, then another one called Write On, and then my mind just exploded. My mind, and all I think about was sort of beautiful women in beautiful clothes in distant lands, and America was amazing. And my mind was just blown. Beautiful women in distant places in beautiful clothes.
You remarked earlier that you came to London as a refugee. To what extent did you understand what was going on politically in Ghana?
I mean, we knew that, you know, my dad was in the army and there was a coup and the president was overthrown and my dad was aligned to the president. And we knew from 1 minute to the next, my dad was gone. And we knew, you know, we'd heard of coups and we knew we weren't safe until the day we came home and said, you have to leave now. So that evening we left and I got to England and, you know, I'd grown up in an all black country. So there I was in a country, you know, brutalist buildings, cold weather, and a place where I was the other, a place where I wasn't the norm, you know, and I first experienced the police sort of stopping my brothers. You know, we arrived when Maggie Thatcher was president. I'm so sorry, Prime Minister. And for those who don't know Maggie Thatcher, she was, you know, she was a very right
Iron Lady.
Yes. And there was a thing called the SUS law where you could stop and search anyone you wanted. So my dad was very angry and upset, you know. And I realized that we weren't in Ghana where you just run to the beach and run around barefoot, that we had to really come to terms with a new place and a new way that we were seen.
How did the new place help foster that creative part of you? That spacey part of you that was when you were little, but that as a teenager you thought, oh, maybe I can do something with this. Maybe this will be who I am and what I do.
I mean, I remember one day, you know, going to college and I was 16 on the train and there was a man on the train staring at me and I was so naive. I was almost scared. I thought I'd done something wrong. And he gave me his card and he was one of the most famous stylists in the UK. Simon Foxton, and he asked me to model for him. And it was such a new world for my mother. But you know, teenager, I wore her down. And eventually I entered this world of fashion media and styling and clothes and models, all those things I'd been dreaming about all those years ago, but I couldn't put a name to it, actually existed. It was a world. And photography, and I could be a part of it. And then my space, my imagination was gone. You know, I could, all those women I kept seeing when I was younger, I could now dress them for photographs that would go into a magazine for the world to see. There was no turning back.
My guest is Edward Enninful. He's editor-in-chief of British Vogue and European editorial director of Vogue. His memoir is called A Visible Man. Edward will be speaking tonight at the Apollo Theater at 7:30 p.m., as well as The Strand tomorrow at 7. So it's interesting, you know, you took over ID when you were so young, when you were 18. And I was thinking about this in context of you just recently joined TikTok.
Yes.
And in your one of your first TikToks, you're talking about how you're excited to be there, to be around young creative spirit and to be around these creators. And I thought it was so interesting because so often we think, oh, can you give the reins to a young person? But when I worked at MTV, the joke was the intern was the most important person in the room because they were the young people living life and being out in the clubs and in the streets. I'm curious how you think about how we incorporate young people. And what is exciting to you about TikTok, given you were that young person once upon a time?
I mean, you know, young people for me are so integral to the future of any industry. I was mentored. I had great mentors, you know, Simon Fox, Franco Sanzani, Terry and Trisha Jones. So every day I want to mentor. I want to bring young people up with me. It's so important. That's how you change an industry. So I do that every day. And as for social media, I'm so forward-looking. I'm so curious. I'm not one of those people that sits back and goes, I know, I'm done, I'm a certain. No, I want to know what social media is doing. And social media really gets a bad rep. You know, I know it's not great for some young kids' mental health, but at the same time, it didn't exist when I was growing up. If a young kid wants a job, they can be employed through social media. You know, direct. I've seen photographers who don't even have agents. In my day, you had to have an agent. You had to know people. It was exhausting. But now, you know, they can form networks. You can find your group. You can find people who are like-minded on social media. So I think even though there's so many bad things about it, there are also good things about it that didn't exist when I was growing up, which is you can create a network of like-minded people and you don't have to depend on agents, et cetera, to be able to move ahead.
No gatekeepers. No one telling you you're not this or you're too that. You can just go be you.
You can just go be you. And also, sometimes I get messages from so many kids, direct messages, saying how do, you know, asking for advice, you know, how to get ahead in an industry. When I was growing up, I didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, there should be more curation on one hand, but I feel like it's sort of leveled the field in terms of the fashion industry.
In your book, you're really candid about struggles with alcohol.
Yes.
And also some very serious health problems. When you look back on why you were drinking and why you chose to participate in AA, why were you drinking too much at the time?
I mean, you know, most people sort of go through life, you know, and they find drink, but I got a job when I was 18, a very intense job, you know, looking after a magazine. But also at that time, I didn't have the luxury of assistants. So I'll have to, you know, shoot the covers, write the features, write the shopping pages, help with advertising. It was a one-man army. And when you're 18, you just want to succeed. So I worked and worked and nonstop worked. And through the 80, you know, through my 20s, working and really realizing, as in, the, you know, alcohol could really numb the emotions, you know. Also, I felt, you know, this imposter syndrome that I didn't belong. You know, how dare you? You just arrived not so long ago and you're heading a magazine. So all these things contributed. And I remember in my early 30s, and it was my early 30s when I decided to stop drinking. I mean, most people don't even stop. But in my early 30s, I thought I wanted to get my life together. I wanted to focus on my relationship. You know, and I wanted to sort of be a better person and get to know myself because I'd been running so fast as a teenager, forward motion. And I was just I was just, you know, soul sick, as I described it.
Mm. And you had pretty serious health issues, some of whom, I have to imagine when you were diagnosed with, I don't know how to say it properly, so I'm not going to, I'm going to let you say it.
I had sickle cell trait when I was growing up, coupled with thalassemia, which is a blood disorder that causes extreme pain. And then because I've always had bad eyesight, I had a retinal detachment, but an eye that kept detaching, four surgeries later, but all through this working and pushing myself. I remember one incident coming out of hospital and having to go into a studio to film. Another instant, it happened and having to get on a plane to go to work. And the beauty of all this is now I've learned how to look after myself. Now I've learned about wellness. Now I've learned about meditation. And now I've learned to say no. It's a very powerful word. To say, no, I can't do this. No, I can't do this right now. No, I can't be here. For young people listening, no is a very powerful word. And I know when you're growing up in any industry, you think you can't say that. But you can. No and why, my two favorite words.
My guest is Edward Enfield. The name of his memoir is A Visible Man. So you're in a position of power in 2020. Obviously across the globe, across the United States, across the globe, so it's reckoning about racial injustice and systemic racism and equity and equality. What did you know you wanted to do in that moment?
I knew in that moment I wanted to help in my way, which was through the magazines. I also wanted to somehow create a document of the time so nobody ever forgot this time. So, you know, we were all in our houses, fragmented, all my stuff, we couldn't be together, you know, that period was quite intense, and we couldn't shoot, you couldn't interview people, so it was a really hard time to run a magazine. But then I remember thinking, when they said over 60s should stay at home, I remember thinking, we can't have that prejudice. So I put Judi Dench on the cover, who was 85 years old. And then, you know, I looked outside my window and saw the postman, the woman who worked in the supermarket, you know. That was when leaving your house could equal death. So I thought, let's put essential women on the cover, real women. And then after that, it was that we were in the pandemic, and then the biggest social movement of a time happened when George Floyd was murdered. And I put, I think, 30-something activists from all over the world on the cover in black and white, just to show there are people out there fighting for justice every day. As the world seems to be going back, these people were trying to help us move forward. So it was a great time for the magazine. For me, a magazine should reflect the times anyway. So it was great to create issues that, you know, held up to society. It was like a mirror of what was happening at the time. And I hope in 20 years, when you look at it, everybody will know what we went through.
In 2016, you were approved for a membership of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, the OBE, for services to diversity and fashion. You tell a hilarious story in the book about your father dancing at the after party. what did this moment mean to you? And while I have you on this day where there's, as we are speaking right now at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time in New York, the Queen of England is extremely ill.
Yes, yes.
So I'm curious, what first your thoughts on the membership, and then your thoughts on the Queen.
I mean, you know, the UK embraced my family, took us in, you know, gave me a life. So it was a very special place. So when I was offered the OBE, you know, I totally accepted it. I knew it would make my father, who you know, essentially had to flee to give us a better life, you'll make him so proud. And as you said, that I had a party that night, and there he was dancing away, surrounded by Madonna and Naomi. And, you know, the UK had been good to me, the Commonwealth. And the Queen, you know, giving me that honor was sort of a high point in my life. And I'm really wishing her the best, and, you know, really watching the news to, hoping, you know, she can recover.
Go. How do you think the process of writing this book? Excuse my dog. I know you have a terrier as well named Rue.
I love dogs.
Understand.
Really? Yep, terrier.
How did thinking about your own family history, your history, how do you think writing this book changed you and your life, and maybe the way you'll approach something going forward?
I mean, it was very cathartic. It was very cleansing. You know, looking, going through. I guess everyone thought I was going to write a book about shoes and earrings and hats and furs, but I'm new. I do that every day. I don't, you know, that book might be later, but it wasn't now. But what it's done is it's given me a sense of peace. You know, I spent my whole life looking for a home. You know, we left Africa, came to England to find a home. Then I had to leave home. Then I moved to America, and I never found it. But I realized, writing this book, that home was with my husband, my dog, my closest friends and family. And it took me 50 years to find it. And I'm so happy I did.
Edward Enninful's memoir is called A Visible Man. Edward will be speaking tonight at the Apollo Theater at 7:30 p.m., tomorrow at the Strand at 7. Edward, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.